Good morning.
Good morning.
Shall we pray?
Yes.
Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time together and for this gathering. Let the meditations of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, and let us come to a closer understanding of your ways and your means. In your Son's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
This morning, we're going to be talking about George Washington and how history has perceived him over the years. Originally, in the first 100 to 150 years after he passed away, he was portrayed in the books as a Christian, as a good Christian leader and somebody that everybody should aspire to. And then in the mid-20th century, there was a movement amongst historians to get rid of all the myths about our national leaders and tell the truth about them so that they became more real for us and they weren't these marble gods on pedestals that we all looked up to. And that's not exactly a bad thing, but in the fervor of some of the historians in trying to tell the real story, they got the real story wrong. Okay? So, we're going to go and look at George Washington, and he grew up in Virginia. He was born in about 1731. He grew up on a small farm near Fredericksburg. It's called Ferry Farm, F-E-R-R-Y, not F-A-I-R-Y, because it was near a ferry going across the Rappahannock River. And you may have all heard the story of when George was a young boy, he chopped down a cherry tree. He could not tell a lie, right? That's a lie. That's a myth. That one was developed by Parson Weems, who was the first biographer of Washington, and a lot of the stuff that he put in Washington's biography was designed to teach young children how to behave. There was also the story in there of him throwing a dollar across the Potomac, right? That did happen, but it wasn't the Potomac, and it wasn't a dollar. It was actually a piece of slate, probably about the size of a shilling in those days, and he did throw it across the Rappahannock River. And if you've ever been to the Rappahannock River near Fredericksburg, it's a couple hundred yards wide, and you can actually skip a stone across the river there in the summer when the river is low and it's flowing kind of flat. Don't try it in the winter. It won't work.
So it's not true that a dollar went further?
No. As I said, it wasn't a dollar. It may have been a shilling, but it was more likely a piece of slate or a round stone. In fact, he was known for his arm and for being able to throw things when he was younger. He was quite a studly young man. You got to remember that in his day and age, the average American was about 5'5", 5'6". Okay.
The males.
The males, yes, the men. Okay. Washington has been described as anywhere from 6 feet tall to 6'3", and anywhere from 180 to 210 pounds. He was the best horseman. He was the best dancer. And he was a very reluctant ladies' man. He was a little shy. He didn't like to talk about himself, but he liked to go to parties and he liked to dance. And he could ride anyone into the ground in a fox hunt. And as he grew up, all he wanted to be was an officer in the British Army. That was his main ambition in life. He even attended a small military school for a while when he was very, very young. And he also attended the Church of England, which in that day and age was the Anglican Church, and after the Revolutionary War was called the Episcopal Church. So they had a lot of emphasis on the Ten Commandments, a lot of emphasis on the written prayer and so forth, and they had prayer books, so they still do have prayer books. Every morning he would get up and he would read a certain prayer out of his prayer book. His old prayer book still exists, and there are notations in it that he made as a young man growing up with this prayer book. Now, there's another book that helped form his life. It was these 101 quotations or something like that, or 101 rules of a civilized man or something like that that he grew up with and memorized as a young gentleman. And he also made quotations or notations in that book. His father died when he was young, and he was raised by his brother, his half-brother Richard. And his half-brother Richard is the one who started Mount Vernon. In his teens, at the age of 16, he became a surveyor. And he lived out in the wilderness. And being a physical man, it fitted his personality. It was said that he was very, very slow to anger. But once you got him angry, don't stay close to him. Okay? Get out of his way. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. By the age of 16, he was working for Lord Fairfax, surveying the wilderness of the Allegheny Mountains, 16 years old, out in the boondocks, all by himself, just him and his mule and his horse, carrying his surveying equipment and so forth. In 1753, at the age of 21, because of his reputation as a good surveyor already, he was hired by Governor Dinwiddie of Virginia. He was also given a major's rank in the Virginia militia, and he was also given the unpleasant task of going to a French outpost that was being developed in the Ohio River Valley, and he had to go there and tell them, no, 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 you can't come here. This is British property. You have to leave. He's only 21 years old, and he's now a major in the Virginia militia. He's got his nice uniform on, and so he and a guide, it was something like 300 miles through this backwoods, you know, that nobody had ever gone through, probably except for some Indians. So he gets to this Fort Leboeuf near Erie, and he tells the French, and he delivers the letter to them, and the French say, oh yes, monsieur, come in, sit down, have some food, and while we read the letter, and then we can send you on your way in the morning. And of course, the letter said, nine, this is our land, we will stay here, and we will protect it if we have to. And so they sent Washington packing on his way. Well, on his way home, he had these tremendous experiences. He almost drowned when he fell off a raft in the middle of a river. His Indian guide shot at him and almost killed him and missed him by... He was 15 feet away and missed him. He had to almost carry his horse back home because his horse was almost falling down and from weakness and everything. So he traveled the last several miles of the journey on foot, dragging his horse behind him. He writes an account of his journey, which becomes a bestseller overnight. And by age 22, George Washington is known throughout the colonies. Now, at age 22, George Washington is called before Governor Dinwiddie again, and he's now given a lieutenant colonelcy in the Virginia militia. He's also given about 140 men. You are to go to Fort Duquesne and kick the French out. Now, Fort Duquesne is near Pittsburgh in the Ohio River Valley. That was also claimed by Virginia. You've got to remember that in that day and age, a lot of the claims that were given to the people in the colonies spread from sea to sea. Mm-hmm. So Virginia's claim went all the way through the river valley, all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Pennsylvania's claim went all the way across. New York's claim went all the way across to the Great Lakes and so forth. So later on, there was a lot of give and take when they decided which states were going to be where and so forth. So he goes to the French Fort Duquesne, and on the way there, he ambushes a French detachment that had come out to meet him. And this Indian chief that had come up and met Washington and knew they were coming said, hey, listen, I know where these Frenchmen are that you can attack really, really easily. And the French didn't know they were coming, of course. But see, the French were allies with a rival Indian tribe that this other Indian didn't like. So he thought, maybe if I get on their side, I could become a big, powerful Indian chief in this area and get rid of my enemies. So Washington and his boys surround this French contingent, ambush them in the morning, and kill at least 10 of them. One of them is the Lord Jumonville, who is a French diplomat. He was also the leader of the expedition, and Washington finally wakes up and says, ooh, you know what? A couple of these guys got away. They're going to go back to Fort Duquesne, and they're going to get a bigger force, and they're going to come after us. Okay, so us little dogs need to go find some place to hide. So they went back to a place called Great Meadow. They built this rough fort called Fort Necessity. And it starts to rain. And it rains, and it rains, and it rains. And of course, while it's raining, the French and their Indian allies arrive and start attacking the fort. Well, Washington and his men put up a bit of a struggle and then decide, you know what, this isn't working. Ever heard the old phrase, keep your powder dry? They had no dry powder. So sticking with the pointy end is all they could do if they got close enough. So Washington gave up, raised the flag of truce, and supposedly signed, you know, really nice conditions of surrender. Well, his French wasn't all that good. He signed a document that said he was a murderer of the French diplomat. So, our little friend Georgie Porgie started the French and Indian War. Because that's what happened. That was the beginning of the French and Indian War. Washington and his men fired the first shot in the French and Indian War. The French never forgave him after that until, of course, the American Revolution, when they said, oh yeah, let's bygones be bygones, because he's not as big an enemy as those guys in the red coats are. So eventually the French joined us in the Revolution. Now, he supposedly accepted this job of going to Fort Duquesne because he may have been having some troubles with a lady. Remember I said he was a reluctant ladies' man? Well, he may have set his heart on one lady, and she sort of said, well, I'm not ready to settle down with any one man. So that was the cause of the French and Indian War. Now, remember, he wanted to be a British officer really, really badly. Please, 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 please. Now, in those days, all you had to have was a certain amount of money in order to buy a rank in the British Army. To be an ensign, which was the lowest rank, that's the guy who carried the flag and got shot first, you had to have a certain amount of money. To be a lieutenant who stood next to the guy carrying the flag and got shot second, you know, you had to have a certain amount of money. To be a captain, you had to have a certain amount of money. Well, he had enough money, he could have bought a captaincy. And so he and his family wanted a captaincy in the British Army. And the British said, oh, no, my friend, you see, you were born in the colonies. Won't do. Simply won't do. No. You can be an officer in the colonial militia, of course, but never in the British Army, my friend. So he was crushed. He didn't know what to do. So the British finally came to the United States with this big, big landing force, really important British general named Braddock, you know, right, proper British man, you see. And Washington attached himself to Braddock as an aide, as a lieutenant colonel in the Virginia militia. And he tried to tell Braddock, you know, they don't fight here the same way as they do in Europe. It's not a good idea to put all your British troops in front and your wagons in the middle and my men at the back, because my men can't scout for your men that way, and they can't get up and support your men because the roads here are too narrow. In some cases, you may not even be able to get your wagons through, let alone your big guns. So Braddock said, oh, no, man, I've been doing this for all my life. I know better. So Braddock went marching off towards Fort Duquesne, same place that Washington had gone the year before. And guess what? The French and Indian knew they were coming because they made so much bloody noise going through the woods. They had to chop down the trees in order to make a wide enough road to get his big guns through. So, at a place that is now called Braddock's Falls, named after General Braddock, of course, and he did fall, the French and Indians ambushed them. And shot, they were up in the hillies on either side of the road, and it was a little bit like shooting fish in a barrel. And within the first 10 or 15 minutes, Braddock was down, his second-in-command was down, almost every English officer was down. Washington took command, ordered his men from the rear of the wagon train up forward to help protect the flanks. He took command of the British soldiers and saved the day, and eventually got them out of there and retreated. He was the last officer left standing. And it was his first or second experience with fighting, and afterwards it was said that he had been killed. So he had to write a letter to his brother, much as Mark Twain had once written about the accounts of his death are greatly premature. He says, "Dear Jack, as I have heard since my arrival at this place a circumstantial account of my death and dying speech, I take this early opportunity of contradicting both and of assuring you that I now exist and appear in the land of the living by the miraculous care of Providence that protected me beyond all human expectations. I had 4 bullets through my coat and 2 horses shot under me and yet escaped unhurt. We have been most scandalously beaten by a trifling body of men, but fatigue and want of time prevents me from giving any of the details, the fact that the general was stupid, till I have the happiness of seeing you at home, which I now most ardently wish for since we are drove in thus far. A weak and feeble state of health obliges me to halt here for 2 or 3 days to recover a little strength that I may thereby be able to proceed homewards with more ease. You may expect to see me there on Saturday or Sunday. I am, dear Jack, your most affectionate brother." And that was to his half-brother. He had also written to his half-brother another letter where he talked about he had heard the song of bullets on the battlefield and he liked their melody. Or something like that along those lines. He came alive in battle. Soldiers said that, you know, you talk about Jackson getting this light in his eyes at the time of battle. Washington supposedly did too. In fact, Washington, remember I told you he was slow to anger, and when he did, don't get in his way. I can't remember which one it was, whether it was the Battle of White Plains or the Battle of Brooklyn Heights. At one of those battles, his men took one look at the British, didn't even fire a shot, dropped their guns, and turned and ran. Washington was so angry, he drew his sword and rode towards the British lines all by himself. It took 3 or 4 of his aides to corral him and bring him back into the American lines before he killed himself on the British bayonets. Of course, it was later on that night that he had the brilliant idea, you know what, we're in this fort, the British are out there, they're going to come get us in the morning. And so he gets a hold of Glover, this Marblehead fisherman who has a regiment of Marblehead militia from Massachusetts. They're all fishermen. He says, "Listen, we're in a tight spot. I need you and your men to row us across the river." And that night, this real heavy fog descends on the battlefield. The British can't see anything except a couple of lights burning on the ramparts of the American fort there. And that night, Glover and his fishermen row Washington and his men across the East River or the Brooklyn River, I can't remember which one, out of harm's way. His entire army, 5,000 men, one night, across the river, just like that. And in the morning, this little contingent of men is all that the British find in the fort when they storm the ramparts. Boom, 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 boom. Oh, there's nobody here. And they're all gone. And this is...
picture? That's not the famous picture, right?
Hmm? No. Okay. Which one are you talking about?
The famous picture of him.
Oh, that's the Delaware.
Gotcha. Okay,
same group of men did the rowing.
Okay.
But that was on Christmas Day, 1776, about 6 months, 4 months after this event. And it's kind of funny, it's the same general that he does it to. Yeah, exactly. So, after the Battle of Braddock's Falls, Washington goes back home to Virginia. Dinwiddie makes him colonel-in-chief of the Virginia militia. He trains the militia. He sees to it that they have proper equipment. He spends 2 or 3 years training them, getting them all fit and proper. He spends time on the frontier with them, fighting small skirmishes against the Indians. He sleeps on the ground with them. His men love and adore him. They follow him anywhere. Okay? and then he retires because his brother dies and Mount Vernon reverts to him, and he goes home to try and take care of Mount Vernon because it's falling into disrepair. As he is taking care of Mount Vernon, he becomes more and more dissatisfied with the relationship between the American colonies and England. And you got to remember that George is a elected member of the House of Burgesses in Virginia. That is the House of Representatives in Virginia. When war breaks out up in Boston, up there, with, you know, Paul Revere's Midnight Ride and all that stuff, and you've got people from all over congregating in Boston to take care of this situation. You got men from Rhode Island, you got men from Connecticut, you got men from Massachusetts, New York, you've even got some Virginia militia that have made their way up there, and some North Carolinians too. And the First Continental Congress is called, and then the Second Continental Congress is called, and Washington goes as a member of the Virginia delegation. He wears his colonel's uniform when he goes to serve in the Continental Congress. Now, he doesn't use that uniform to say, hey, look at me, I'm an officer in the army, I'm great. He wears it because he's trying to show the people of his willingness to serve. Remember that his motto is, for God and country. For God and country. Does that sound like a deist to you? Okay, and we'll talk about what a deist is in a minute. And so he spends his time there, and one of the reasons he gets chosen as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army is because he's from Virginia. And Virginia is right in about the middle of the 13 colonies. So the people in the South are going to say okay. People in the North are going to say okay because they know him from his book that was written several years ago, and they know what a wonderful person he was then. He was a great adventurer. Oh, yeah. Okay. Who knows? You know, he's never commanded anything larger than a couple of hundred men, but other than that, you know. So he becomes commander-in-chief, and even then, he writes a letter to Congress saying, I'm not worthy. And he says, you know, in the hands of Providence, I can do this. In the hands of Providence, I can do it. Everything he does while he is commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, he attests. Every victory he makes, every good move he makes, every good thing that happens to him, he attests to Providence and the hand of God being on him and on their cause. Okay? And he is one of these guys. He probably wasn't the greatest general we've ever had. He made some really, really bad mistakes. You talked about him fooling a British general twice. Well, British general fooled him three times with the same maneuver. Attack here and then come around here. He did it at New York. He did it at Brandywine, and he did it at Germantown. Okay, so yeah, he got caught a couple times too. His victories at Trenton and Princeton. You were talking about the picture of him in the boat. Well, again, he talks to Glover now. One of the great leadership qualities of Washington was his ability to make you look forward to a trip to hell. Okay? Glover says, we can't do it. There's no way we can get the entire army across the river in one night and then bring them back across the next day. My men will be too tired. They won't be able to fight when we get there. Their hands are going to be, you know, blistered. What about the cannons? What about the horses? What about this? What about that? And Washington says, I'm sure you'll figure it out. And Glover, of course, does. And he and Henry Knox, who was the fat bookseller who knew everything there was to know about artillery, even though he'd never fired an artillery piece in his life, they got all the guns across, they got all the horses across, and all the king's men across in one night. In the Battle of Trenton, there are various accounts. Some say Washington lost only one man who fell asleep on the trail and froze to death that night. Others say that he lost two men during the actual battle with the Hessian troops in the town of Trenton. So somewhere between two and three or maybe 1 and 3 is the number. They captured over 700 Hessian soldiers. Now, this is the, one of the reasons why Glover said it was impossible to do. Yes?
Can you explain the Hessian?
That's what I'm going to do. The Hessians came from Hesse in Germany. Now, Germany at that time was not a country. Germany was a conglomeration of many different little city-states. Schleswig-Holstein, Hesse, Sweringen, Thuringen, and a thousand other places. King George III was German, and all these little princes in Germany owed him favors. So he said, I'm going to America, and I'm going to make them obey me, and I want you to come with me, yeah? And they said, oh, sure, yeah, okay. And so because the Hessians were the biggest contingent of the German troops that came here, they were all called Hessians by the Americans. They were either called Hessians usually, or they were called Germans. They were the ones who had the darker blue jackets, the high mitered caps with the little silver ball on top and everything. And by the time of Trenton, the American soldiers did not like the Germans, because at the Battle of New York, the Germans used surrendering Americans for bayonet practice. And so they had little empathy or sympathy for any of the German soldiers. So many of the German soldiers were shot in their nightclothes, in their beds that morning. Okay? So they got a little revenge. So a day later, Washington pulls another coup, several days later, the Battle of Princeton. The British are marching to Trenton, thinking they're going to find him there. Washington leaves a small force on a high hill overlooking the route to Trenton. They fight a delaying action. Washington takes all the rest of his troops up to Princeton, catches the British out in the open, smashes into them, and defeats them at the Battle of Princeton. Of course, he loses his best friend, General Daniel Mercer, at that battle. But he also gains a lot of interest in the Army. All of a sudden, men start coming out of the woodwork, and they start volunteering for the Continental Army. Okay? Now, why was the Battle of Trenton so important? Because for many of these soldiers, their 9-month enlistment was going to end January 1st. The Battle of Trenton was fought, or excuse me, the Battle of Princeton was fought January 1st or January 2nd, one or the other. So these two battles, Trenton and Princeton, saved the Army. And Washington knew he had to do something to hold the Army together, or else it would go like a covey of quail. And that would be the end of the Revolution, because the Army was the Revolution. Without the Army, there was no Revolution. So Washington, after the Battle of Princeton, and everybody came back, he came back across the river, by the way, and they came back across the river to the area opposite Trenton, and the next morning he calls all the soldiers out. He says, I know you want to go home, but your country needs you. Mm-hmm. And he pleads with the men, and a few of the men step forward to re-enlist, okay? And he says, I know it's hard. I know it's difficult. I'll tell you what. For every man who reenlists tonight, I will have Congress give you a $10 bonus. Well, $10 was a month's salary in those days. So for a month's salary, another whole bunch crossed the line. Now, the problem is, Washington had no right to promise them that $10. So eventually, Congress did go through and say, yes, okay, we'll do that, okay? He talks about the character of his of a soldier, okay? And now, deists believe that God sort of made Earth and then went off and left it working, like a certain amount of clockwork. That's a clockwork deist. There are other deists that believe God occasionally steps in to, tweak the clock once in a while. Yeah, okay. This is what Washington said about what a good soldier and a good officer should be. Now, you tell me if this sounds like a deist. The general hopes and trusts that every officer and man will endeavor so to live and act as becomes a Christian soldier defending the dearest rights and liberties of his country. And these were in his general orders issued on July 9th, 1776, the day after the Declaration of Independence was read to his troops, and about 6 months before the battles of Trenton and Princeton. Okay? A Christian soldier, not a deist. Not a deist soldier, a Christian soldier. He went on, and you remember I told you that he was one of these guys who was able to talk people into doing things. I don't know if you've ever heard of Nathanael Greene or not, but he was the one who helped win the Revolutionary War in the South for Washington. Well, before he went down south, he was a friend of Washington and on Washington's staff and so forth. And at Valley Forge, Washington and his troops were starving to death. And they didn't have a good method of procurement, of supplies and so forth. He takes his friend Nathaniel aside and he says, "Listen, I want you to become my quartermaster general." And Greene says, "Quartermaster general? Who ever heard of a quartermaster general in history?" And Washington says, "Is that what we're all about? Is that what we are aspiring to be looked at by history for glory only?" And he said, "Remember, it's for God and country." And Nathaniel said, "Yes, sir," and went out and became the best quartermaster general the United States Army has ever had, of course. Quartermaster general is the one who gets the food, he gets the clothes and everything like that for everybody, and takes care of their quarters and so forth, because they had men going on guard duty with nothing but rags around their feet. Some of them didn't have a jacket. They would share a blanket in a hut with four or five men, and the man going on guard duty got the blanket. Not good. And as bad as that was, Morristown, a couple of years later, was even worse, and we'll talk about that in a minute. He is also the one who said that there must be chaplains in each regiment. Now, does that sound like something a deist would say? And he said they must be men of good Christian character. At the Battle of Monmouth, and now this gets into our idea of Washington being slow to burn, the Continental Army had this one character who thought he should have been king. His name was Richard Lee, and no relation to Richard Henry Lee, the one who introduced the Declaration of Independence. He thought that he was better than everybody else because he had actually been a British officer, you see, in the old days. So he knew more about anything than anybody else because he has been a British officer. And, yeah. So Washington decided to give him one last chance to prove himself. He had been captured by the English and been exchanged, and so this was going to be his chance to redeem himself at the Battle of Monmouth. What was happening is the British were moving from point A to point B, and this is 1778. Washington and his troops were coming out of Valley Forge for the second time. They had been trained by the German drill master, Baron von Steuben, who had come in and represented himself as being this fancy major on a Prussian general staff, and he had actually been nothing more but a captain, if that. Most say he was probably a sergeant. And but he had a letter from Franklin, as did many men who came to help the colonial cause in those days. They all stopped in Paris first, saw Franklin, said, "I'm this, this, and this." Franklin wrote a letter, sent him to the United States. They went to the Continental Congress. Continental Congress said, "Yes, that's good." Signed the letter and then sent him to Washington. So that's how he got Lafayette. That's how he got Pulaski. That's how he got von Steuben. And that's how he got Kosciuszko, the guy who built West Point. So here's von Steuben, and it took the Continental soldier 18 steps to load his musket. The Continental line could get off 2 shots per minute. The British line could get off 3 shots per minute. Slight disadvantage. Not only that, the Continental soldier didn't like the pointy end very much. They weren't afraid to bash each other over the head, but they didn't use the bayonet very much. So von Steuben said, "Give me the best 2 men in each company from each regiment, and I'll train them. Then they go back to their regiments and train more men, and then I'll train more men. And that's what happened. The army that came out of Valley Forge the second time was very well trained. The British didn't know this was coming because these guys could shoot almost 4 rounds per minute. They could actually shoot faster than the British. They knew how to use a bayonet now, and they had a new determination. And their numbers were good. He had almost 7,000 men. And here were the British with 8,000 men. They're marching from point A to point B. Washington says, I got them. I can attack them in the middle, split them, and, you know, defeat them in detail. And he goes over the plan with all of his officers, with Knox, the chief of artillery, with Light Horse Harry Lee, who's the chief of his cavalry and so forth. And he talks and he shows them what I want you to do. And he says, and, you know, General Lee, Richard Lee, you will lead the troops and I will bring up the reserve. And Lee says, oh, it's about time. So Lee goes and attacks the British. And as soon as the British see the attack coming, they form up. They turn around and come back against the Americans because they think it's the same Americans they've always fought. All they have to do is form up, you know, point their bayonets at them, and they'll run, right? Well, the American soldiers start to fight. They're firing, they're fighting, and Lee all of a sudden says, retreat. What? Yeah, exactly. that's what the soldiers say. What? And so they're starting to walk away from the battlefield, and here comes Washington on this big gray charger, and he says, men, what are you doing? You know, he says, well, we've been given the order to retreat. Washington immediately makes a beeline for Lee, chews him out in rather blue language, as I've been led to understand, as Henry Plum Martin said, he's a connoisseur of swearing. He never heard such good swearing as he did on that day. And relieved Lee of command right there on the spot and said, leave, get off this field. You are no longer welcome here. So that's a big disgrace. Lee took Washington took over command, had Knox place the artillery correctly, and turned the battle around. It's the only time the vaunted Black Watch, which is a Highland regiment of the British Army, it's the only time the Black Watch has ever left the field without permission. Mm-hmm. It's the only time they've left the field. Because, for one thing, the cannonade was so intense, but the temperature that day was in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And you got to remember, they're wearing wool kilts, wool socks, wool hats, wool coats. And it's very, very humid. And many men died of heat exhaustion that day. So, yeah, it was a bad day all the way around. So, later on, there's the Newburg conspiracy. This is about 1780 or 1781. And the army is in an encampment at a place called Newburg. I can't remember whether it's in New Jersey or Pennsylvania. And all of the officers are just upset. They haven't been paid in weeks and months. The men are upset. And what they want to do is they want to revolt and make Washington emperor. Or, you know, at least set up a military court, right? And they've got this letter circulating through all the officers and all the men, and they're all signing it, and finally. And Washington says, you know something? This isn't such a good idea. And, that, you know, they're complaining about how much they've lost. You know, my wife has to take care of my farm. My wife has to take care of my business. You know, I've lost a tooth. I've lost this. I've lost that. And Washington calls them all together in a big barn, and he says, oh, it's in the temple, which is the Jewish meeting house there in Newburg, evidently. When the general took his station in the desk or pulpit, which you may recollect was in the temple, he took out his written address from his coat pocket and his spectacles with his other hand from his waistcoat pocket, and then addressed the officers in the following manner. Gentlemen, you will permit me to put on my spectacles, for I have not only grown gray, but also blind in the service of my country. End of conspiracy. Yeah, they all, by ones and twos, they all stood up and left. That was the end of it. No one had ever seen Washington wear spectacles before. He had kept it a secret. Now, this is the kind of leader he was. He didn't want his men to know that he was human like everybody else, I guess. But as he goes on in life, he keeps coming up with these little things like this to surprise people and have them, you know, say, oh yeah, that's a good idea. After the war, he's the most powerful man in the United States. He commands the army which has defeated the most powerful army in the world at that time. And what does he do? He says, I'm going home to farm. He gives it all up. And you got to remember that Washington, when he took command of the army, took no salary. Remember, for God and country. His idea was that you served your country because it was the right thing to do. Not because you were going to get rich, not because you were going to get famous, because it was the right thing to do. So he goes home to farm Mount Vernon, and he does a lot of good things. He experiments with crops, peanuts, things like that, cotton, potatoes, and other things like that. He is one of the forerunners of crop rotation. He learns how to use crops to re-enrich the soil and so forth. He has a monopoly on nails. You ever heard a nail called a four-penny nail or a six-penny nail or a ten-penny nail? Well, the reason is because nails were used as a medium of exchange during colonial times and up through the early years of our country. He who had the most nails wins, right? Well, Washington and Jefferson each had a couple of slaves. Each one could turn out around 500 to 1,000 nails a day, depending upon the size of the nails and so forth. And I've done this in a blacksmith shop. Nailing is not an easy thing to do. You have to get the nail to the right diameter by pushing it through a punch and then knocking it out, and sometimes it gets stuck in the punch because you let it cool too fast. Now you got to hit it on the pointy end and knock it out and everything. It's a long process. I think I could make one nail every half hour or something like that. And here are these guys turning out 500 nails to 1,000 nails a day, right? Well, this helps make Washington and Jefferson rich men when they were very young, okay? And they use this money very, very well. Jefferson, you've got to remember, was very, very strong in farming, but he was also very, very strong in architecture. He's the one who designed the University of Virginia. So he did a lot of work along those lines, and Washington and he became friends. In fact, Jefferson served as his Secretary of State at one time. Washington became very, very upset with the way things were going after the war, with the amount of taxation that the Congress couldn't collect, and how much Britain was still eking out of us, but not only eking out of us, but controlling us, all right? Because they would send something over and they'd say, okay, well, that's going to be $3 when it gets there, but when it got here, it'd be $4 or $5 because the British would put a tax on it on that end. And so we were at their mercy in many ways. So Washington, Madison, all these guys, they finally had it. They'd had it up to here. Madison is the one who helped start this movement, but he couldn't do anything without Washington. Why? Washington was the most famous man in the United States at that time, maybe even the world. You got to remember, he wrote a book that was a bestseller back in 1753, just before he started the French and Indian War. Okay? So everybody knows who Washington is. He defeated the British, and so he helps get on this bandwagon with Madison. Madison says, if we've got Washington, we've got it. Now, the idea originally for the Constitutional Convention was to tweak the Articles of Confederation. Well, the very first day they said, no, that's not going to work. We're going to scrap it. They closed the windows. They closed the blinds. you know, they shuttered the building so that nobody could peek in and see what was going on. Let nobody in from the press. We're going to make something new. Guess who they chose as the president of their convention to keep everything moving along smoothly? Georgie Porgy Puddin' and Pie, right? Because they knew he was the man that everybody would look to. Okay? If you've got a dispute and you want somebody with a certain amount of wisdom and, you know, unbiased viewpoint to settle this problem, who do you go to? Washington. Washington helped settle a dispute between Hamilton and somebody else in that convention. One of the biggest disputes that they had was over a bank. Should the United States have a bank? And sure enough, we ended up with a bank, okay? Because Washington said, yeah, how can the government do business without a bank, okay? You're giving the legislature the power to tax. Where are they going to put that tax money, okay? Also, in that day and time, you had every large city issuing its own money. You had every state issuing its own money. Banks issued their own money. Was a dollar bill in Georgia the same as a dollar bill in New York? So they had to fix things. And that's another reason why they went through the Continental Congress or the Continental Constitutional Convention. And this is why Washington was elected as our first president, too. It's because of his reputation and as his ability to settle problems. The whole idea behind the original Constitution was to be a document to lead people to intelligent discussion and to come up with a middle ground, give and take. Unfortunately, today it's all take and no give. So after Washington passed away, everybody looked upon him as a good Christian man to be emulated and so forth. And as I said, Orator Parson Weems wrote his book as a guide for young children, how to behave and how to be good and so forth. You know, yes, I chopped down the cherry tree, I cannot lie. That was a lie. In about the 1960s, this guy Paul Bowler wrote a book about Washington and religion. He's one of the first ones to come up with this idea that Washington was a deist. And this is the official definition that I got off their website. Deism is a recognition of a universal creative force greater than that demonstrated by mankind, supported by personal observation of laws and designs in nature and the universe, perpetuated and validated by the innate ability of human reason, coupled with the rejection of claims made by individuals and organized religions of having received special divine revelation. And Alexander M. Cohen, one of the professors or the philosophers of deism, says that it's the metaphorical clockmaker that once he started the universe, the Big Bang, he willfully stepped aside and let it run without hindrance. The first one that I read to you, the ability of human reason, you know, I wonder where they get the ability of human reason. Where does that come from? Ooh, Providence, perhaps? We talked about him discounting death. We talked about what he said about the Christian soldier and so forth. Later on, when he was president in 1780, he was talking about what made our country good. And he says, Providence, to whom we are infinitely more indebted than we are to our own wisdom or our own exertions, has always displayed its power and goodness when clouds and thick darkness seemed ready to overwhelm us. Providence. The hour is now come when we stand much in need of another manifestation of its bounty, however little we deserve it. Okay? He depended upon God and Providence. And one other thing that you want to talk about is his idea of, you remember we talked about the Christian character, and others say, well, he never used the word Christian. Oh, yeah, he did. Okay. In 1798, where is it? Delaware Indians, yes. These Indians wrote to him asking him what would be a good way to teach their young ones. And he responded that they would do well to learn our way of life and arts, but above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. Does that sound like a deist? No. Okay. We talked about Christian character. Talk about the character of soldiers again. While we are zealously performing the duties of good citizens and soldiers, we certainly ought not to be inattentive to the higher duties of religion. To the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian. Okay? So, this author here does a wonderful job of showing that he was not a deist, and in his inaugural address, he says, it is the sacred fire of liberty and the destiny of the Republican model of government are justly considered as deeply, perhaps as finely staked on the experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. That's not the one I wanted. It's this one. This is a Thanksgiving proclamation shortly after that. It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and humbly to implore his protection and favor. See, providence for Washington was a very, very active thing. It saved him at the Battle of Braddock's Falls. It saved him when he fell off the raft and almost drowned. It saved him when the Indian guide, standing 15 feet away from him, fired his gun and missed. And there are some authors, one of them, James Flexner, who wrote a single-volume book of Washington, the Indispensable Man, who claims that our country wouldn't exist without Washington. He claims that it's providence all through Washington's life doing things to help him and help our cause together, working together. It is an active providence that is guiding him to wherever he's going. So, this idea that Washington was a deist, I think, is probably a whole bunch of hokum. All right? Do we have any questions at this time? Yes?
I just have a comment. I think you did a really great job, except you kept mispronouncing George Washington's name.
Georgie Porgy?
Did you call him Washington instead of Washington?
No, there's no R after the A.
I'm not a Midwestern.
Yeah, I know. Even though I was born in Wisconsin, I don't always have the same accent as I used to have when I was a kid. So, yes.
Can we have the book title and the
author? Oh, yeah. This is George Washington's Sacred Fire, by Peter A. Lilbeck, Lilbeck, Lilbeck. And it's in our library there, but you can't have it yet because, as you can see, I'm only halfway through.
Now, he's a PCA pastor,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah. Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Oh, you have? Oh, neat. Yeah. And he's written several other books, too, about history and so forth. We were talking about this fact that some people said, well, I never saw George Washington take communion, okay? Well, here's the wife of Alexander Hamilton telling her granddaughter, I shared the sacrament at the rail with George Washington. Now, in case you don't know what that means, in a lot of the churches, especially the Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church, the Lutheran Church, you come up to the rail and you kneel, and the host is given to you as you take the sacrament of communion. Okay? So she says, I shared the rail with him. That means she knelt right next to him. Others, remember I told you that Morristown was worse than the first Trenton. In fact, it was so bad that if it hadn't been for a particularly early run of shad up a particular river right there by Morristown, the army would have starved to death. They were down to eating their shoes. And here is a stained glass window from the Presbyterian church in Morristown, and he's celebrating communion after the miracle at Morristown with the fish coming up the river. So here's the stained glass window commemorating it. So you can't say that he never took communion. In fact, there are many generals and officers who wrote in their memoirs and so forth about sharing communion with Washington in the field. You see that okay? Okay. Yeah, here's Washington here. Yes.
At what point did his beloved Martha enter his life?
Shortly before the French and Indian War.
Okay.
And it was considered to be a really good match for both of them, from what I understand. Okay. Oh, you have the book. So here's the window right here. I don't know. I haven't gotten that far yet. Okay, it was told in another book that I've read.
Well.
Yes. That was The Indispensable Man by Flexner. The Indispensable Man is a single volume summary of his three volume biography of Washington. So Flexner has, in fact, I think he's actually come out with a third one, but I don't remember the name of it. But he is a very, very good expert on Washington. Flexner is his name, F-L-E-X-N-O-R, or N-E-R, I can't remember which.
What's his first name?
I think it's James.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why do they think making him out to be a deist makes him more,
Well, because... there are more, supposedly, all right, there, these.
They just don't want us to be a Christian.
Right, well, you got to remember that when you go F-L-E-X-N-E-R, James Thomas, George Washington, Anguish and Farewell is one book, and then his other book is Washington, the Indispensable Man. Many of these authors have come from history departments that have become liberalized over the years. And the idea is that we're going to teach history from the standpoint of what America has done to other countries. America is not as good as you think she is. That's what happens. Right, exactly. So I sometimes wonder where some of these professors would rather be. You know?
They're still living here.
Yeah.
Just a quick note, I'm taking a history class right now. It's actually California history, but my professor is at a state school, and my professor has done, in all of our discussion boards, everything to paint the Americans and the American history that we have as running over the top of people, and just as negatively as he possibly can. And it's
one
been,
of the problems,
very disheartening.
Right. One of the problems with a lot of modern historians is that they look at history with a modern perspective,
right.
And you can't do that
it's
and
like
write
you
accurate
read
history.
The Bible and think that the things that happened in the first century were written to us in the 21st century. They were written.
Mm-hmm.
To those of the first century, and that's your first, look at it
right.
As far as interpretation.
Right. Okay. Any other questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned Washington's intense desire to be a British officer,
mm-hmm.
and then you were talking about how he did everything for God and country. So at this point, when he said that, is he thinking England? Or
well, you got to remember that up until
even
the first Continental Congress, when they met, they still considered themselves Englishmen. They wrote the Olive Branch petition directly to King George, asking him for redress of grievances against Parliament. Mm-hmm. Parliament was the one who's enacting all these taxes. Parliament is the one who is, you know, crushing us down. All we are asking for is the rights of Englishmen, because you've got to remember that every charter that was ever issued to anybody who came to the United to the New World guaranteed them that they would have the rights of Englishmen in the New World and the protection of the king.
Back to the Magna Carta, right?
All the way back to the Magna Carta, right. Okay? So, but when George got the letter, guess what he did? I'm going to teach these people a lesson. And the Second Continental Congress met after the debacle in Boston and Lexington and Concord, and they bottled the British up, and that's when Washington went in his colonel's uniform, you know, and said, you know.
So at this point, where is the American consciousness as understanding, starting to understand themselves as?
It's one third in favor of the revolution, one third doesn't know about the revolution, doesn't care about the revolution, and one third are what we used to call Tories. They are very much in favor of the king. If you want to talk about how it split families, Franklin's son was governor of New Jersey and was a Tory. So Franklin had to, you know, cut relations with his son. Washington's mother was a Tory, and she didn't write letters to him during the revolution.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Get a question?
I wonder if Josiah Quincy Franklin was the son. But anyway, what I want to add to your thing is that if you abstract God out of history, you irrelevantize it. And so if we can prove that George Washington was a deist, that the founding fathers were, according to Harold Rugg, a friend of John Dewey in the progressive education back in the 1930s, was that the War of Independence was about greedy businessmen who wanted to enslave the poor. And that, and what Harold Rugg did in his book called The Great Technocracy, he said, what I want to do is I want to take away things that make history God's work in history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it says, like in Psalm 88, I believe it is, 78:2, but it also says how, you know, shall God's works be known in a land of forgetfulness? Does God do great things? He wants these things made known to generations to come, Psalm 78. If you don't, then the children forget and they turn back in the day of battle.
Sure.
And so with the Great Technocracy, Harold Rugg took those things out. So the idea that George Washington had bullet holes and was shot 15 feet away and Providence saved him, take it out of history. God saving the pilgrims, take it out of history. God preserving, you know, just different battles, providential actions of God. Anything that pointed to a divine providence, they take it out. And then if they do that, all you have is dates and facts, and nobody cares. And even teachers will say, there's no reason to teach history, there's no meaning to it, but I'm being paid to.
Yeah, that's the wrong way to look at it.
Absolutely.
Because there's no way you can take out the emotional aspect of history.
Right.
And where do your emotions come from? Mm-hmm. Who gave us the emotions? Right, okay.
They wouldn't even really be allowed to teach history in public schools if they kept it history.
Yeah, good story.
But they stopped teaching a lot of, because when I started bringing out in Chicago, when they started teaching the history, when I was in my first year of high school at Little Bloom, they started beating the white kids up. Because they said the whites did the blacks real bad. Oh. They stopped breaking their legs and they had to stop teaching it. In my first year of high school at East Chicago High School at Little Bloom.
Yeah.
At the Little Bloom.
That's why it's important to learn so it doesn't happen again.
Right.
I really enjoyed everything you said and you agree with it. It's been said that there's two righteous wars, only two that America's ever fought. Now, I'm going to say some things that some of you aren't going to agree with. Let me say. two righteous wars we've ever fought. One was War for Independence, and the second was the Southerners' defense against the Northern invasion. Now, a lot can be said these days about by revisionist historians, revisionist to the good sense, that America's not righteous as we want to believe. For example, this nationalism that started with Hamilton and Washington in the National Bank has moved in conflict after conflict through the, you know, Hayne debate in the Congress against, what was it?
Jackson.
Anyway, it conflicted and finally culminated in the Civil War. States' rights against centralized national government.
Right.
Lincoln won. He obliterated the South, and he obliterated the idea of a dispersed states' rights, free republics under a union. And by that, we have now centralized national government beyond control. Hope we can get it back. But, other things are saying, that we've, through history, we looking at it hard, I mean, they butchered the Indians with Jackson, slaughtered them, and went right on through with the generals, the Civil War generals, brutal dogs that destroyed the Indians after the Civil War. What they did in the South, which was, in a sense, the French Revolution here in America against the Southern people. In the Philippines, 100,000 people, white.
The morals.
You know, and on into the Middle East. So we are now a nation it is under the pall of evil. I mean, we've got to break it.
Mm-hmm.
And
The problem here is what drives some of the people that go out and do things like that, like the taking over of Hawaii, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, the Pineapple Kings and so the so it too much of our, especially in the late 1800s during the Gilded Age, too much of our history was driven by greed. And this movement in the 1920s, 1930s, up until the 1960s, to take away the myth of history and tell it like it really is a reaction to what was going on during that empire of greed in the 1880s. So, yes?
Oh, my friend gave me a great quote from Ronald Reagan. Socialism does work, but only in two places. In heaven where they don't need it, and in hell where they already have it.
Okay, we're out of time. Let's end in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this time together. Let us go forth from here and think about the ideas we've talked about. Think about George Washington and what a wonderful leader he was, what he gave up in order to be a servant to you and this country. We ask this in your son's name. Amen. Amen.